This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.
Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Man whose intelligence I have the highest regard for and who has been kind enough to grace us with his presence here to share it with us from time to time is my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Dr. David Wormser. He's a senior fellow of the center and has been working tirelessly on matters involving the Middle East and global anti-Semitism. He brings to this subject lots of experience in the United States government, including notably as special assistant in these matters for then Vice President Dick Cheney. He has worked with John Bolton in a number of capacities at the State Department, the NSC. He's also served in the United States Navy's reserves as an intelligence officer, and he is a serious, thoughtful analyst of what's going on in a very dynamic and increasingly, I'm afraid, dangerous part of the world. And we're anxious to catch up with him about it all. David Wormser, it's good to have you back. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for giving us a full hour of your time today. We're anxious to talk with you about a whole host of issues and happy to have the ability to do so at length.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure and an honor. So it's wonderful to be on.
Thank you. Feeling is mutual. Let me ask you first and foremost about Ibrahim Raisi, a man who has been elected, in a fashion, as the new president of Iran. What do we know about him, his background, and the implications of his election, for starters, for the people of Iran?
Well, I think one of the key factors in understanding this new president, Ibrahim Raisi, is that he was like so many of the members of this regime in Tehran, he built his reputation on brutality. Whether it was the mayor of Tehran, Kalibaf, who in a previous round of elections was a serious contender, who made his way sending little children onto the battlefield with plastic keys to heaven to clear minefields, or whether it's Raisi, who is known as the hangman of Tehran or the butcher of Tehran, because he sent thousands of people, thousands of political prisoners to their death. These are people who have trafficked heavily in brutality. And that seems to be a main qualification here is, are you willing to kill to keep this regime on top? Raisi is definitely a symbol of that willingness to be a butcher, to be brutal to whatever extent is necessary, probably to an extent more than necessary, to keep this regime in power. So I think that he's a symbol of the regime. It's real face, by the way. That's always the power behind the regime. Even when Rouhani, who was ostensibly a more moderate, palatable figure, the real power lay with the IRGC leadership in this clique of brutal people surrounding it all along.
David Wormser, it seems as though, of course, all of this brutality and repressiveness stems from, is emblematic of, and is very much the leitmotif of the regime led by the so-called supreme leader, irrespective of who is the president. Talk a little bit about the Ayatollah Khamenei, his role at the moment. We've been told for years that he's at death's door. Is he? And is it your expectation, as I've here brooded about, that this butcher of Tehran, Raisi, is expected ultimately to be his successor, not just the president?
Well, yes. The current leader of the country, the real power behind the throne, or really the throne itself, is Ali Khamenei, the only the second to hold that position after Ayatollah Khomeini, who we all know from 1979 and the embassy and so forth. Khamenei himself has been fairly brutal. He has been, there were a number of assassination attempts at him early. Not that that shaped his brutality, but it certainly reaffirmed the idea that brutality is a key to survival. After these attempts, he really aligned himself with a specific clique within the IRGC, the clique that we now know included people like Soleimani, who was assassinated by the United States a year ago, or a year, 2 years ago now, and other people who, like Raisi, like Kalibaf, and so forth. So Ali Khamenei has had a long history of being on the tough side of this regime. I emphasize toughness is not a question of moderation or hard line. There is really no moderate camp in Iran. The question is the techniques and the manipulativeness that is necessary to get to your goals. You have one faction that believes in much more raw power and exposing the West's unwillingness to act and weakness, and is willing to confront the West more directly. And another crowd that believes the West is still very dangerous, so you have to have a much more manipulative and refined policy toward the West. That's the real difference between the various camps.
So there's a question of tactics towards enemies of Iran, not the fact that we are all enemies of Iran, and that we must be dealt with as such.
Correct. Exactly. We are enemies, that the expectation at the end of days is that we will go away, we will be destroyed. Not that we will be challenged and that they will set up shop and have an area of influence, but their expectation is that they will destroy the West eventually. Now, there are some internal differences in Iran about the return of the Mahdi and the mystical element. One crowd believes
this is the Messiah figure for them that they believe will come out of a well,
exactly,
and usher in the golden age of Islam, right?
That's right. Right. 1,000 years ago, the 12th Imam, according to the Shiite lineage, disappeared and will return. And when he returns, it's a new era. It's essentially an apocalyptic era. And there will be a great war, and the Imam will lead the Shiites, the true believers, to victory alongside Muhammad and an army of the dead and the army of the believers today and so forth. And there's an idea that you can bring about his return by taking certain tough positions and hardline positions. So there is a certain apocalyptic crowd versus another crowd which believes, well, he's not coming back anytime soon. We're dealing with the here and now, so we have to make our way to win against the West, destroy the West through the manipulation and so forth. So there is this internal difference. And by the way, Khamenei traffics heavily with the crowd that believes in the incoming apocalypse. This was Soleimani, this was Ahmadinejad, and several others were trafficking in these ideas. So even in that, Ali Khamenei, who's the real leader, he falls on the most terrifying side of the spectrum. And Raisi is clearly his man, and Raisi is clearly being groomed through his position in the presidency now to be his successor.
So to put a fine point on this, David, there is in the ruling clique in Iran, whose numbers are now being formally augmented by Raisi's promotion, a faction that believes that something that sounds an awful lot like the apocalypse is going to be used to bring back this Mahdi figure. It's also been said, David, that there's an expectation that's going to happen on Ali Khamenei's watch. And so if he is in ill health and if his days are numbered, as are, of course, are all of ours, but if his are particularly short in number, this is a very frightening prospect that the key members of this ruling group feel that they need to precipitate this outpouring of lamentations and great hardship in order to bring back the 12th Imam. Am I right about all that? And doesn't that really signal we're dealing with people who are even more dangerous than people who think they will destroy us over time?
Yeah, no, you're completely right about all that. And I think that does emphasize exactly how dangerous this ruling clique is. And also it emphasizes something else, which is that our foreign policy establishment doesn't fully understand how deeply held belief can inform policy. I think there's a lot of dismissiveness of that sort of an ideology as, oh, come on, we don't really believe that stuff. Or, well, in the end of the day, they really won't act on it. So there's a dismissiveness. I remember when we used to get speeches, when I was in the vice president's office, we used to get these translations of speeches, and the CIA would cut out all the religious stuff up front. And then just focus at the tail end on some statements that were made that seemed to be directly influencing policy, which, by the way, were usually simply for foreign consumption. But at any rate, the whole religious part up front was the real thing. And we didn't get that because we have such a predisposition against believing that belief really can inform policy. And they
the believers believe actually believe things.
That's right. That the believers actually believe things. And in this particular case, we're dealing with a group of people who tends to be apocalyptic, like you described properly. And that is a terrifying prospect. So when we deal with the possibility of their acquiring a nuclear weapon, deterrence is not the first thing that jumps to mind. It's apocalyptic use that jumps to mind. And that's the real terrifying aspect of this crowd.
Well, this brings us to the proposition that we have been endlessly impressed by in the various, well, appointments for the one thing and policy pronouncements of the Biden administration, that they are determined to negotiate with the Iranian government and have been doing so since they came to office, a re-entry of the United States into this so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal, for want of another term. Where are we in those negotiations, David, as best you can tell? And shouldn't what has developed here with the election of Ibrahim Raisi and the prospect that he is going to be ascending, perhaps in the not-too-distant future, to even higher, more powerful office, the supreme leader, shouldn't that warn us off this whole idea of negotiating and thinking that a nuclear deal will matter?
It should warn us off, but it likely won't. Where we stand right now, we don't fully know. They're definitely keeping the lid on details of this negotiation. They're signaling in public difficulties. But at the same time, in private and in leaks and so forth, we keep hearing that there's very substantial progress. So I would assume that there is more progress than what meets the eye. And these negotiations, the Iranians right now have broken them off to have consultations in Tehran. Again, I would suspect because of significant developments. So I'm not sanguine about the prospect of a tough American position that will hold the line and keep the Iranians from getting a better deal. We went into these negotiations basically with the idea that we would have an Iran nuclear deal plus, a little bit enhanced. It was clear from the start that the best we would get is an Iran nuclear deal minus, because the Iranians knew we were desperate to re-enter the deal. It was one of the main campaign promises of the administration, and the staffing of the Iran portfolio within this administration indicates that we were serious about coming to a deal at any cost. So Robert Malley, for example, is the key person in charge, and he has made it very clear over time that he believes any deal is really preferable at this point to no deal. So the Iranians have all the leverage, and they know that they can negotiate a tough position, namely that they would get a better deal than what they had before, which was already a bad and flawed deal from our point of view. As far as Raisi's election, a reasonable person probably would conclude, well, with a hardliner like that coming in, or apocalyptic-minded person coming in, or a butcher who has obviously no regard for human life coming in, one would have to take a more cautious position, because Iranians have cheated on virtually every single nuclear agreement with the West they've made. So with a tough person like that, we shouldn't concede that much, because they'll cheat on their end of it anyway. But the truth is, the administration looks at it in the inverse. They've known for a while that Raisi will be elected, because it was clear that that's what Khamenei wanted to have happen. So it was going to happen. They see that as a stopwatch to the negotiations, namely that they have to come up with a deal with the, quote, moderate government now to avoid having to make a deal with the tougher hardline government. Implementation and actualization of the deal, it doesn't seem to be a great concern of theirs. It seems to be more getting to the deal and having the diplomatic feather in their hat, essentially, of getting a deal. So for them, Raisi's election is a tremendous incentive to move full speed ahead. And what we're hearing from various sources, including the Israeli press, the American position has begun to concede wholesale considerable amount.
It's hard to imagine how it could get worse from the get-go, this desperation to get a deal, which is so reminiscent, of course, of how the Obama administration managed this. Some of the same people involved in that fiasco that led to this joint comprehensive plan of action in the first place, of course, is it kind of boggles the mind. I remember, David, I think we've talked about this in the past, John Kerry, who I think is in the mix on the grounds that everything has to do with climate change and has relations with the Iranians from his time as Secretary of State and in the Senate and so on. He conducted himself in such an appalling manner during his time, injecting himself personally and directly into the negotiations on this JCPOA. He was described by our European allies, contemptuously, I think, as the Iranians' lawyer. And it doesn't seem as though the present crowd at this moment, under these circumstances, is behaving any differently. And God help us, because clearly this is going to have implications both in the region and beyond. And I want to turn to that a little bit, David. We are watching the Iranians on the ground in a variety of places. I had an opportunity recently to participate in a very interesting program with the Montgomery County Republican organization with Shoshana Bryan. And she described really the aggressive activities of the Iranians from Yemen, where they are working to encircle Saudi Arabia and have an ability to choke off traffic in the entry to the Red Sea. Of course, what they're doing to choke off entry to the Persian Gulf at the other end, the Straits of Hormuz, but right on up through Lebanon and Syria and Jordan, and of course their threats to the Gulf states in the Persian Gulf area, and not least Israel. Just kind of walk us through, David, if you would. Is this an accurate characterization of the current state of play with the Iranians, that they're emboldened, that they're acting even more aggressively, and will almost certainly respond to further efforts by this administration to appease them in ways that will make matters still worse?
I'd say not only is it an accurate statement, but it is probably an understatement. Every day you wake up and you read about another Iranian activity, another Iranian effort to destabilize the region. And we're not talking about small things. We're talking about major steps. So you see the Iranians, for example, sending these two ships. We thought they were on their way to Venezuela. Instead, now they seem to have gone through the Straits of Gibraltar and are heading toward the Eastern Mediterranean, namely against Israel, shore up Syria and Lebanon. These are two the very large ships that are essentially IRGC platforms for operational activity.
That's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the sort of military branch of the regime.
Exactly. Essentially a very large-scale terrorist organization. It's been labeled this. So what you have is directly an escalatory threat against the Israelis right there. Perhaps the Israelis will take action against it, but these are very serious issues. We see the use of drones destroying oil facilities in Saudi Arabia, clearly launched by Iranians. The magnitude of what happened in Saudi Arabia a year ago with the drone attacks was kept a lid on it to keep oil prices from going through the roof. But essentially, the Saudi oil production was halved for quite a few months because of this Iranian attack. In the last war with Hamas, the Israelis intercepted quite a bit of equipment and even drones coming from Gaza, which may or may not have been manned by Iranians. But clearly, there was a set of drones that came in from the north during the war. The Israelis haven't talked about it all that much. But during the war with Hamas, some drones crossed in from Syria and northern Jordan that were clearly sent by the Iranians themselves onto Israel. They were shot down so they didn't do any damage. And then we see the Iranian activities with these various militias in Iraq and Afghani militias and so forth operating in Syria, in Lebanon, and heavily, obviously, in Iraq. We see how aggressive they are against American forces. Every couple days, we have another set of rocket attacks on U.S. forces and U.S. contractors in Iraq, let alone against the Iraqi regime when it doesn't do what the Iranian regime wants it to do. So literally every day you turn around and there's a basket full of activities that the Iranians have done really on the strategic level to attack us, to attack our allies, and to destabilize the region.
Yeah. Is it fair to say, going back to what we just were talking about in terms of this administration's preoccupation with getting a new deal, that more or less the administration is turning a blind eye to all such behavior? I mean, even attacks against Americans that, if they haven't already, will almost certainly at some point, entail casualties.
Casualties and hostages. I mean, when we saw the North Koreans were hesitant to divulge, to give up the money that they had frozen under sanctions, the Iranians a few months ago took a South Korean oil tanker hostage, essentially, in the Gulf until the South Koreans gave in. So we see
gave in and paid a ransom.
Exactly. That's exactly what they did. And I'm sure they got the green light from the United States. From my dealing with the Koreans and Japanese in previous administrations, they won't take a step on Iran without first clearing it with the United States. So I can't imagine that South Korea would have done this, would have released the money as essentially a ransom payment without it having been greenlighted by the United States.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Iranian mullahs have chosen a serial murderer as their regime's next president and supreme leader in waiting. At such a moment, Israel's most seasoned premier, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been replaced by a fragile coalition dominated by leftists and Islamists. And the Biden administration is determined to appease our enemies in Tehran and undermine our friends in the Middle East. A second opinion on U.S. policy towards this increasingly dangerous region is clearly needed. Fortunately, Senator Ted Cruz has just returned from the region, where he imparted a sense of solidarity to allies and steadfast opposition towards our adversaries. The senator will provide an exclusive debriefing about his trip and its findings and what he proposes to do about them during a Center for Security Policy webinar at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday. Register to participate in this most timely presentation at securefreedom.org. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Now, this is in addition, David, just so I'm clear, is it not to a previous release of funds that the South Koreans held to the Iranians that was one of the early lubricants for this diplomacy of the United States?
Yes, I believe so. Yes, it was after the original bunch of money was released. Yes. So this is an additional amount. And nothing has really happened after these attacks on American forces and American contractors in Iraq. We're basically right now in stand down mode vis-a-vis Iranian activity against us. And as far as the Israelis go, the Israelis do respond, but at the moment we're putting Israel at distance as an ally, dissociating ourselves from the Israelis and asking them to tamp it down. There's at least two waves of American requests to the Israelis to basically sit on it or calm it down with the Iranians, all for the sake of coming to a deal on the nuclear issue, which is not really going to stop the Iranian nuclear program. So, yeah, you have an administration that is completely turning a blind eye. And at the same time, it's abandoning, or there's a sense of it's abandoning our allies. And I just mentioned about the Israelis for the first time in 4 years facing American pressure not to act on its interests, its vital interests against the Iranians. But we have the constant humiliation of the Saudi regime by this administration. And moreover, now we hear that we're pulling out the most sensitive, most important forces we have in the region, which is Patriot batteries. These are the batteries that protect Saudi Arabia and others from these Iranian attacks. These are defensive installations that have no, you can say, like the administration does, well, the Saudis are committing human rights violations in Yemen or so on and so forth. But these Patriot batteries have nothing to do with that. These are simply defending installations that are critical to American interests, like oil facilities, from attack from Iran. And where we're throwing them. So the signal being sent is weak.
David, let me just interject that we are going to be treated tomorrow to a very important conversation about all of this with one of our country's top legislators, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who is coming to the Center for Security Policy for an exclusive debriefing on his visits to the region recently and his interactions with some of the key players that are obviously intimately involved in trying to contend with the various dynamics that you're talking about, whether it's Iran, whether it's our policies. And I really commend to everyone in this audience this upcoming presentation. Please register to participate in it at securefreedom.org. That's 2:30 Thursday afternoon Eastern Time. And now, David, let me just dwell on this issue of Saudi Arabia a bit more. What you've described, of course, is calculated to intensify the pressure that the Saudis are feeling from the Iranians. I don't know how it could be otherwise. We're also at the same time witnessing, as in the New York Times yesterday, I think, this report that the individuals charged with murdering this journalist named Khashoggi a couple of years ago were actually trained in the United States. What can you tell us about the facts of the matter, first of all, and the revelation of this information is further pressure on the Saudis?
Well, the Khashoggi affair is sort of this mystifying event for most people, even those of us who follow the region often got lost in what's going on with the Khashoggi affair. But just in a nutshell, there was a journalist, but he's a Middle Eastern journalist, which one has to always be careful of, because they're usually also advocates for ideological positions. But at any rate, this is a journalist who was very closely associated with the Turkish Prime Minister, Tayyip Erdogan, and the Muslim Brotherhood. And he was working with the Turks to galvanize, essentially, the religious opposition to the government of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a government very... its very foundation is this deal between the Saud family and the religious establishment. And if you shake that, you're shaking the foundations of the Saudi regime. You're essentially threatening its very existence for hundreds of years. And yet the Saudi regime is trying to reform. So it's beginning to engender some religious opposition to some of the reforms they were undertaking. And the Turks were very happily trying to exploit that to destabilize the Saudi regime. And the point man to do that was this journalist, Khashoggi, who is of Turkish descent, but Saudi nationality. And they were using him as the conduit to these various religious leaders, Muslim Brotherhood leaders in Saudi Arabia that were beginning to destabilize the regime. By the way, the Muslim Brotherhood is now banned in Saudi Arabia. It has been banned in Saudi Arabia since 2014.
Properly so, I might add, as a terrorist organization.
Properly so.
And you know, David, what's stunning to me is that there's been scarcely any mention of any of this background in the endless and understandable, to be sure, denunciations of the Saudi government for its role in his very appalling liquidation, literally. But the truth of the matter is, this what you've just described is a very real internal threat to the regime, which is, after all, an ally of the United States in its fashion, at the hands of a government that, while nominally an ally, has become increasingly aggressively hostile both to us and to our friends and allies in the region, not just the Saudis, of course, but the UAE and Kuwait, I think, and certainly Israel as well, no, namely the Turkish regime of Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Well put, Frank. I mean, that's exactly correct. Wherever you go in the region, there is this Cold War, often not so Cold War, between the Turks and the enemies of the Turks, which are countries more aligned with the United States and desperately trying to, frankly, moderate or change Islam in a fundamental way, namely the UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and so forth. I mean, that's the real backstory behind the Abraham Accords. It's on one side, clearly, a decision by the UAE and Bahrain that Israel is a strong horse in the region and just happens to have a perfect alignment of common enemies. Number one of which was obviously Iran. So there was no reason for UAE not to come to terms with Israel, there was no reason why it should continue to allow the Palestinians to veto that. So that was the foundation of the Abraham Accords. But one shouldn't underestimate the extremely high level of importance attached to the Turkish part of this as well. We see the Turks acting very aggressively also in Israel. In the last war, in fact, the one a month ago, a lot of the equipment in the Hamas had was paid for by Iran, but had come from Libya, from areas under Turkish control in Libya. So these were Turkish-supplied weapons paid for by Iran. And I think that tells you something, that the Iranians and the Turks, to some extent right now, though at the end they will hate each other and they will destroy each other, because that's been a fundamental strategic conflict for 400 years. But for the moment, they have common enemy, which is the United States, Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and so forth. So there's a common sort of strategic divide in the Middle East. And unfortunately, what's happening here is that the United States, for its irritation with Saudi Arabia, for whatever reason, is frankly siding with our enemies. And then with the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, it's siding with our enemies. And then with this attempt to resurrect the peace process in Israel and to essentially bring back the Oslo framework, it's trying to undermine the Abraham Accords, which again works against our strategic interests in the region.
David, I guess what I'm always struck by is I hear this kind of analysis from you and others is that when Joe Biden talks about America being back, one of the things that we all should be alarmed at is we're back to a policy approach that basically makes it better to be an American enemy than an American friend. It's hard to imagine a more benighted approach or one fraught with more danger, especially at a moment such as this, which I just once again, return to this point about the 12ers in Iran thinking they're going to bring about, you know, apocalyptic outcomes and bring death to Israel, the little Satan, as they say, as well as death to the great Satan, namely us. We ignore this at our peril. And we didn't get into this, but I do think everyone listening should be very concerned by your anecdote about what was happening during your time in the Bush administration, let alone what's going on now in terms of the Central Intelligence Agency's briefers filtering out information that helps explain the theological or ideological agenda of such enemies, notably in Tehran. And it blinds us to a strategic reality at a moment when I think we simply cannot afford to indulge in that. David, I've got so much more I want to talk to you about. Let me just turn to two other topics in the time we have left. First, you mentioned the government of Israel and how this administration is now treating the so-called peace process, trying to resuscitate it. Talk a little bit about the new coalition, its character and its weaknesses and its implications.
Well, Israel has finally a new government after 2 years of election rounds, four of them to be precise. They couldn't return a verdict in a clean new government. So now there is a new government, but the new government is a coalition of it's a national unity government, but only in the way one would describe having everything in the kitchen sink in one place. So you have parties that are in this government that are, frankly, to the right of Prime Minister Netanyahu, the outgoing Prime Minister Netanyahu. And you have parties that are far, far to the left on the Israeli spectrum, really the Israeli equivalent of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC. And then you even have Arab parties, two Arab parties. One is extremely radical, calling for Israel's destruction and refuses to cooperate and participate in any Israeli government. And a second party, which has a radical background, but Arab party that has a radical background, but has sort of understood that Israel is strong and that to get their interests satisfied, they're going to have to work within the Israeli system. So they decided to start working within the Israeli system. So this coalition now has all these parties except for that radical Arab party. Even it does include that other Arab party that's decided to work within the system. So there's no common agreement on any foreign policy issue. The prime minister is a religious man who was a settler most of his life, and his party is staffed out almost entirely by settlers. And then you have the Meretz party, which is more or less our equivalent of the Squad. So there's no real commonality on hard left exactly. So you already see the government there foundering on a number of policies, whether it's LGBT, whether because obviously the Arab party, which is based on Islamic ideas, is opposed to it. Religious and Israeli, the more right-oriented parties, who many of whom are very religious Jews, also have a problem with this. But you also have a fundamental disagreement over issues of Jerusalem, the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, etc. So they can proceed on a functional basis to deal with things like corona and so forth. But if challenged, or maybe even Iran, because there's such a wall-to-wall consensus in Israel on Iran that is far more tougher, even on the left, is far more tough than the toughest positions right now this administration could ever conceivably come up with. So there's kind of a consensus on Iran, but really there aren't on all these other issues. So all these other issues coming up probably will bring the government down. I'm a little mystified. The Biden administration has decided to wait a few months with pushing the peace process very hard, although they're already laying the groundwork. They're trying to play games with reestablishing a consulate in Jerusalem. So what you have is
for liaison with the Palestinians in
ostensibly it's to liaison with the Palestinians, but they're not putting it in the city where all the Palestinian officials are. They want to put it in Jerusalem, which what it really means is they're trying to reverse the decision of the previous administration, the Trump administration, to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. It's really that.
Or if not reverse it fully, certainly undermine the strategic value of it, and further again undermine our friends in Israel. David, just on this Israeli government business, I in a conversation with our colleague Carolyn Glick a week or so ago, I think she took the view that this government was actually in the interest of trying to maintain as cordial relations as possible with the Biden administration, had actually signaled that it was more open to the sort of pursuit of negotiations with Tehran than certainly Bibi Netanyahu's government had been. Do you see any sign of that? And if not, I think it would be a good thing. But I fear that there are certainly some within that unwieldy group, particularly in the merit side, that I imagine are more susceptible to this idea than others, even if they all understand at some sort of primal level, as they should, that Iran is a mortal threat to the Jewish state.
Yeah, I think there's still a pretty strong consensus, even among some of the Israeli squad types, so to speak, the Israeli progressives, that the Iranians are a terrifying threat that has to be dealt with decisively. But yes, I think to sort of get into the way it's developed over the last week, my sense is that the new Israeli government has made a point that when it disagrees with the United States, it wants to keep it a bit more quiet, doesn't want to do it as publicly as before. And the second thing is, and I think they're going to be woefully disappointed here, they believe that through this quiet behind-door discussions, they can essentially negotiate a backbone into the American position. So they, yes, on one level, that sanctions the negotiations on the Israeli side. But then the previous administration did essentially the same thing. They demanded better terms to the agreement. They never quite said that they never want any agreement. They simply said the agreement that was pathetic, weak, and would give the Iranians a nuclear weapon. It's basically an on-ramp for the Iranian nuclear weapons program. This administration is doing it a little more quietly, but they're basically saying they want tougher positions from the United States. They're not going to get it. And then I think this administration in Israel is going to have to make a choice, the same choice that Prime Minister Netanyahu, after years of experience, reached, which is if you're not going to get what you absolutely need through these quiet discussions with the Americans, what do you do? So I think in the end, they're going to find that what Netanyahu did was the right policy, which is sometimes you just have to go to your allies in the United States and work with them, even if it offends the administration.
David, this is a very interesting point, and we'll be watching this closely. One other thing that I just would ask you to speculate about, obviously this is purely in the realm of crystal ball gazing. Do you anticipate that the inherent weaknesses of this Israeli coalition, on the one hand, will incentivize more hostile action on the part of Iranians and others, especially to the extent that they perceive daylight between the U.S. government and Israel, point one, and point two, that the government will, in fact, fall in the not-too-distant future and perhaps create the opening for yet another round of elections. Some are predicting as early, perhaps, as September, and the possible return to power of Bibi Netanyahu?
Well, I think the current administration wants to get to a deal with Iran before the government falls in Israel and so forth, and they want to lay the groundwork for a bunch of stuff. So I think it's probably going to last a little longer than September. But that said, I think you described the dynamics perfectly. This administration, through its behavior on Iran and its behavior toward the Israeli government on the issue of the peace process, is going to lead to a breakdown in all fronts. On the Israeli side, they're going to push it to the point where the Israeli government has to act on areas it has no consensus, and therefore it will fall. There's no way that you're right now. The Israeli government has 61 seats. There are 120 seats in parliament. They have a one-seat majority. You can't get more slim than that. In fact, one person has already sort of drifted away. So they have a 60-seat, not even majority, a 60-seat tie. And it takes 61 seats to bring down the government, or a majority to bring down the government. So you really need one person. That's it. And there are a lot of people within this administration in Israel who very reluctantly went along with the formation of the cabinet. So it won't be very hard to bring down this government. If you push issues like Jerusalem, you push issues like the peace process, and you drive hard on it, you're going to bring down the Israeli government. I'm a little worried because this administration here, the Biden administration, doesn't seem to be that terribly concerned about it. And I'm worried that we saw what happened in 2015, which the Obama administration interfered quite aggressively and quite extensively in the Israeli election. And I'm worried that they think that if they have another round of elections now that they're in charge, if you remember, the previous round happened only 1 or 2 months after they took over, so they didn't have time to organize such a campaign. I'm worried that they think they can swing the Israeli election in a different direction.
There certainly is a tradition on the part of these guys of in previous administrations, Clinton's notably, as well as Obama's, of directly intervening to try to undermine or replace Bibi Netanyahu. And that would be a reasonable bet that they would be trying to do it again. I know you'll be watching this closely. I know Senator Cruz will have thoughts on the subject as well, and we all look forward to hearing what he will say about his firsthand on-site inspection, if you will, of Israel and other places, I believe, in the Middle East during his recent visit there. And again, I invite all of you to participate in a very timely, very important review of what we've just been discussing with David Wormser with Senator Ted Cruz during tomorrow's Center for Security Policy webinar at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Register for that at securefreedom.org. David, we only have a couple of minutes left, and this is a very big topic, but let me just ask you a little bit about one of the other parts of your portfolio at the Center for Security Policy, namely global anti-Semitism. It seems as though in the new era here in the United States, it's on the rise, not just in Europe, not just in Canada, heavens knows in other parts of the world where it's endemic, but also here in our own country. You've mentioned several times the Squad as a particularly virulent leftist cabal within the Democratic Party. But talk us through kind of what's going on here as you see it, and in particular, what we are seeing from the so-called progressive left in the Democratic Party inside the United States with regard to anti-Israel, yes, but also anti-Semitic comments and conduct.
Yeah, it's been described to some extent as the Corbynization of the American left. Another Center for Security Policy fellow, Maya Carlin, has written quite good stuff on this as well.
Corbyn, of course, being the former leader of the Labour Party in the United Kingdom and a rabid anti-Semite.
Exactly. He's a rabid anti-Semite. And when he essentially transformed his party into a safe haven for anti-Semitic rhetoric and activity, leading to a breakdown of Jewish support in Britain for his party, but overall also, and he lost the election as a result. But that didn't change his vitriol against Israel. What you're seeing here is a Europeanization of the American left, and with it comes all the ills of the European left. And one of them is a fairly strong love affair with third world Che Guevara type activities, but also of transformed traditional anti-Semitism. The transformation is to try to put it into this global liberation theology, so to speak, and apply it to Israel Zionism. But it's very thinly veiled, and it's more and more coming out simply as raw anti-Semitism. And the problem is that the Biden administration has employed a number of people who are involved with this activity, people who have said anti-Semitic things in the past or have facilitated anti-Semite coming to universities or having platforms viewed as anti-Semitism. So there's an implication of high levels within this administration. Many of its officials have been involved with. One of the worst of them is the head now of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department.
What could possibly go wrong?
So here's a person who's the top U.S. official to prosecute hate crimes against Jews, who herself has facilitated anti-Semites speaking at Harvard University and defended them, defended their theories. And by the way, one really needs to look at some of this stuff. It isn't veiled anti-Semitism. It is raw, unfiltered, hardcore stuff you could pull right out from Hitler's Der Stürmer journal or so forth. And she facilitated it, and she's now the chief U.S. official to try to fight it. It's similarly in time.
I didn't, when snickering about this a moment ago, I didn't mean to suggest that this is other than just outrageous. And yet she was, approved by the United States Senate.
Surreal.
It's
It would be funny if it weren't so deadly.
Well, that's
because
right.
It is turning deadly.
It is turning deadly. We're watching people in places like New York and Los Angeles actually assaulted by anti-Semites because they're Jews. We know where this kind of behavior leads, don't we, David? This is an all too familiar phenomenon. It starts perhaps small, but it does not end well. That's for sure. And so, what is the administration going to do to signal, despite this dismal personnel choice and despite some of the proclivities of the various personalities in this administration beyond the Justice Department, that this is truly unacceptable behavior? I think Joe Biden, at least in the past, has denounced such behavior. Is that in the cards, A? And B, is it sufficient unto the day?
He is condemning it. He's a bit slow to condemn it, but he is condemning it. And he is an old school Democrat who had good relations with the Jewish community. So I suppose he is somewhat offended by all this. But at the same time, condemning anti-Semitism while tolerating anti-Semites isn't really going to help. And that's the problem that we're encountering, is that Nancy Pelosi, her father is really, the mayor D'Alessandro of Baltimore, was really one of the main forces pushing President Roosevelt to recognize Israel and to help Jews get out of Europe in World War II. But Nancy Pelosi is unable or unwilling to confront the anti-Semitism in her own party. So what you have here is they're not anti-Semites themselves, but they're weak and they're tolerating anti-Semitism. And that's leading to a further radicalization. So the effect of it is the same, unfortunately.
As I said to you before, David, I think, I used to work, as you know, for Senator Scoop Jackson, who was a very prominent figure in the Democratic Party for decades and a champion of Israel and an avowed and aggressive adversary of anti-Semitism. I think his experience is particularly shaped by, of course, what he and others of us witnessed after World War II came to an end and the full horror of the Holocaust became apparent, the inevitable sort of denouement of rabid anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany. What is so worrying is the Democratic Party does seem very much under the control now of people who are not just radical leftists, but truly anti-Semites. And as you say, Speaker Pelosi is unable, or certainly unwilling, to challenge them, let alone censor them, for this conduct.
I think what you're seeing, Frank, is that overall the Democratic Party is unable to challenge those elements within it that are launching a fundamental assault on the United States and its history and its traditions. The anti-Semitic issue is really a symbol of the larger issue. The United States has made itself dreamily, since before we were even a nation. I can't emphasize how unique America's relationship with the Jewish people has been since before we were even a nation. This has been an immensely friendly country, that you have letters and interactions between the top figures in our history, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, which would make your head spin how pro-Jewish and pro-Zionist. 200 years before the Jews managed to recreate their state, they were pro-Zionist. So this is an assault on America's tradition of tolerance of Jews. And it's a larger part of the larger assault on America.
Yeah, our character as well. David, we have to leave it at that. I thank you so much for what you do to try to hold us to those higher traditions and values, as well as your extraordinarily clear-eyed assessment of the various threats there too, whether they're foreign or domestic. I know you'll keep up that great work at the Center for Security Policy. I encourage everyone to follow you there. David Wormser is really a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. It's always great to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you for giving us a full hour of your time today, and let's do it again soon.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.